Welcome back to this weekly meeting of the Community Planning and Housing Committee with Denver City Council. Your Community Planning and Housing Committee starts now.
Good afternoon. Hi, I'm Diana Romero Campbell, and I am going to chair the Community Planning and Housing Committee today. Thank you all for being here. Today is October 28th, Tuesday. And let's go ahead and start with introductions, and I will start to my right.
Good afternoon. Flor Alvidres with Lucky District 7.
Good afternoon. Chantel Lewis, District 8.
Hi, Amanda Sawyer, District 5. I'm coming. I'm here. Sorry, guys.
I'll do it real slow.
Every district.
Wonderful. All right. Well, we have a few action items today, and I think we're going to go ahead and start with the host legal services contracts. Are you guys ready to go? Okay.
Ready.
There you go.
Awesome.
All right. Well, I'm going to turn it over to Melissa, right?
Melissa.
Okay. I'll turn it over to you, Melissa, okay. And take it away.
Thank you so much. Good afternoon, everyone. Melissa Toddy. I'm the Director of Stability and Prevention with the Department of Housing Stability, also known as HOST. And I'm here today to talk to you about our Eviction Legal Assistance Program and some contracts that we're putting forward for your approval today. So our action requested is approval of three contracts currently, and then a future action item upcoming. So we have the four providers who were recently awarded through a recent procurement: Colorado Legal Services, the community firm doing business as Community Economic Defense Project, Colorado Poverty Law Project, and Colorado Affordable Legal Services. Just in terms of, we are trying to use this slide everywhere so we can be clear about how our work is broken up within HOST. And so within the stability and prevention landscape, we do rent, mortgage, utility assistance, legal aid. We recently started administering the property tax relief program, and we have some tenant landlord counseling programs, as well as several others in our portfolio. So just at a high level, wanted to talk about the eligibility criteria for these programs. It is for households who have an income at or below 80% of the area median income and those who are Denver residents. The services we provide are really broken into two main criteria: limited representation, which is kind of the light touch. We give you information, help you fill out forms, whereas full representation is we're representing you in court. You're really negotiating with the landlord, more in-depth, hands-on services through that. I did just want to include a slide about how folks can access these programs. So they can reach out directly to any of the four providers, either via phone or their website. And then I think, as most of you know, we also offer a free on-site legal clinic Monday through Friday, just down the hall on the first floor. And so we are usually seeing most of our residents come through the eviction clinic at this point, which is great. And then I also know you're familiar with the eviction filing numbers, also known as FED filings. And so just for some context, prior to COVID, we were seeing about 8,800 eviction filings annually. When COVID hit, there was eviction moratoria, obviously a lot of federal resources. We saw a significant decrease in the number of filings. And then after COVID, we have continued to see the eviction filings increase, especially over the last couple of years. I think it's important to put some state and national context within this conversation as well. If you all aren't familiar, the Eviction Lab tracks a lot of cities across the nation and what is going on in the eviction landscape in those communities. So of the 35 cities that they are currently tracking, 19 or 54% of those had a higher eviction filing rate last year, similar to Denver, that was typical than prior to the pandemic. In Colorado, the eviction process is governed at the state level, And so often we are limited with our policy tools that can be enacted here without first getting state legislation passed for us to do so. I just wanted to highlight one example that I've kind of been tracking over the last several years, which is in Philadelphia. They have an eviction diversion model, which requires landlords and tenants to participate in mediation before the landlord can go through the court process. Philadelphia is now the second lowest filing rate of those tracked in the eviction lab system. And before this policy went into place, they had some of the highest eviction filings. So just demonstrates where policy can be really effective in this work. Every year we send you all a report about the eviction legal assistance. So just wanted to highlight some of the things from 2024. Over 3,300 households were served with eviction legal assistance last year. Majority of the households we served were at or below 30% of the area median income. We do see high representation of BIPOC households, and we also see a high percentage of households who are female head of household. That those trends tend to align with what we see nationally as well. In addition, we did serve slightly more with limited representation, though I think over the years we have seen a shift to be providing more full representation as we've increased staffing. Almost half in which we were able to prevent an eviction judgment. The judgment is the time when the judge rules in favor or against the tenant. Unfortunately, a lot of times we don't know the outcomes of these cases if we are just helping with them filling out forms or giving referrals and advice. And so either the case was suppressed or unknown in about 33% of the time. Only about 10% were we able to identify that they were not, the eviction judgment was not prevented. And then lower case dismissed about 6% of those. One thing I wanted to highlight is some of the research we did last year that I think is really enlightening. So what we found is between January 2022 and January of 2024, there was a little over 22,000 eviction filings. Over 5,200 of those were from households facing three or more evictions during that period of time. So those were from about 1,500 households, so demonstrating 7% of those facing eviction were representing 23% of the filings. So I think it's just important for context. When we see the number of eviction filings, what we're really trying to do is also target those households who are repeatedly showing up in the eviction filing numbers to try to stable them longer term. Some of the strategies I wanted to highlight for what we're trying to do to reduce eviction filings is targeting resources to those serial evictees, like I mentioned, allowing true applicants this year to apply prior to an eviction filing. So if they receive a rent demand, they're able to apply for rental assistance. We're also working with an organization called HomeStart and their Renew Collaborative. They're working directly with Denver Housing Authority to help prevent evictions and homelessness at their properties. We also continue working with Excise and License to enforce the city's ordinance, which requires landlords to provide the tenant rights and resource guide at the time of signing a lease and when an eviction is filed. Better integrating eviction legal services into programs across our portfolio, so making sure residents in all of our spaces are aware of the services that we offer. And then just to highlight, in 2025 so far through September, we've spent about 77% of the $2.5 million and served over 2,600 households to date. So the specific contracts in front of you today are one, Colorado Legal Services. These are three-year contracts. As I mentioned, we just concluded an RFP. And so the three-year contract amount is $1,168,737. We anticipate serving approximately 300 households per year. And the average cost per household is about $1,267. I just wanted to highlight a reason for this higher cost per average or cost per household compared to the others is they really do focus on those living in subsidized housing, and that does often take more expertise and time to ensure stability for those households. Secondly, we have the community firm, RCEDP. Total contract amount for 3 years is $2,768,062.50. We are precise. We anticipate serving 1,033 households per year with this contract and an average cost per household of $871. And the last contract for approval today is with Colorado Poverty Law Project. Total contract amount for 3 years is $2,983,356. About 1,300 households served per year, an average cost per household of $746. And then the contract for Colorado Affordable Legal Services will be coming to you, I believe, next week. Polly's giving me the nod. This contract will be for $768,906, serving approximately 320 households per year at $782 per household. I tried to get through it because I know we have a packed agenda, so I'm happy to take any questions you all have.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. I'd like to welcome Councilmember Torres to the table, and we'll go ahead and get started with Councilmember Sawyer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Melissa, thank you so much. Really, really appreciate all of your work on this. First question, do we know what the cost per eviction is at this?
C'est moi.
So when Councilwoman Sedabaca and I were writing this initially, we could like best estimate what like the cost per eviction was in terms of cost to the city to provide legal aid in the event of eviction, right? So our estimate was based on the number of people who were being evicted. It was like a $4 million a year need. It's never been funded at $4 million.
Right.
And also there's some staffing challenges on the legal side. So I do not mean to suggest in any way, shape, or form we could be doing better. You guys are doing an awesome job with the resources that exist. But I'm just curious whether I think like the most recent number I heard was about $800 per eviction. Is that still accurate?
That's a good estimate. As you saw and I think I actually have an average in here. Did I do it? I did not. We can average it out, but so it is going to be close to about 800, 900 based on what these contracts are. I think in the report last year, we were under 700 per household. So obviously we want to be realistic because we are serving more households, and it can be, especially as we do more full representation, it can cost more and with added staffing. But I think 800 to 900 per household is a good estimate.
Okay, really appreciate that. So that, based on 12,000 evictions, it's $9.6 million of need.
For the households that, again, we're seeing some households who are represented multiple times, and so trying to reduce, obviously, the filings on the front end. Also, not everyone who's facing an eviction will be eligible.
Obviously, under that 80% AMI threshold.
80% AMI threshold. So it won't be, obviously, the full number, but certainly higher than what we're funding it at to meet the need.
Okay, good to know. Thank you. And then it is my understanding, and I don't know that this is true, so I'm caveating this with I'm spreading a rumor at this moment and asking about it, that there were some changes to state law that raised the level of eviction filings this year, but not necessarily the level of evictions. Are you seeing that to be the case based on the clients you're serving?
I think there's always a narrative out there that we have to file an eviction to get access to resources or to, have the tenant respond. I don't necessarily believe that narrative. Obviously, the resources are available to households before an eviction filing is initiated. I don't know what the state legislation how that would have an impact. I know there's also a narrative that because we're allowing folks to access more housing opportunities with a lower requirement for the number of months that you need to reflect income for to be eligible to rent the housing, that has caused some complexities, but that's our housing market. We do need more options for folks to be renting, so.
Okay, really appreciate that. And then last question, just around Philadelphia and the mandatory mediation. So when Councilwoman Sitabaca and I were writing this legislation, we were told by the city attorney's office, point blank, no, that it is not, mediation is not allowed to be required in the state of Colorado. Has anything, so the way it's written is that there's optional mediation, yes, that we would really like for everyone to take advantage of, but we cannot require it. Is that state law still in effect and impacting this?
Correct. Yes.
Boo.
Yeah, boo.
Okay, great, thank you. I'm good, thanks.
Thank you. Council President Sandoval.
Thank you. I was going to ask about the process in Colorado, the eviction process. One thing that happened in Denver with Councilwoman Gonzalez Gutierrez, who was at the state at the time, worked with Robin, Councilwoman Kanich, mm-hmm, and simultaneously worked on something undid, like the, I can't remember, for lack of a better word, the Telluride decision, which opened up us being able to have EHA and inclusionary housing, right? Have we thought about that? Like, is there a piece of paper out there, or is there a decision or a memo from the city attorney that delineates what would need to change for us to be able to mandate this? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I don't think there's been anything in writing. Usually we're responding to, you know, what the city is putting forward or responding to from the legislation that's coming. Yeah, exactly.
But that can work a different way if we think about it. That's just because that's what's happened.
Right.
How do you turn being reactive to proactive?
Yeah.
Right? Because I'm sure this is something that, I mean, if they did it, it's not, I don't see what the harm would be if we partnered and said, hey, let's do this, because in the end, if the goal is to get eviction filings down, why not? Okay, so if I'll follow up with you offline, okay, and I'll have that discussion, because I just need to know what our determination is on it to be able to find someone at the state who could partner, or we could partner with.
Okay,
thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Next up is Councilmember Torres.
Thank you. So the multiple evictions, are they always three, like multiple different addresses? Like, I'm just trying to understand what's happening, that they're getting multiple filings.
Yeah, it's usually at the same address.
Same address.
It's, for example, they have an eviction filing, they resolve, and then a few months later, it's an eviction filing at the same address, they get rental assistance, and then a few months later, that was kind of the only way. I'm sure there's more at different addresses, but just based on the limited data, we were matching names with addresses with eviction filing.
And so it was, or what was the percentage or frequency of it being non-payment as the reason versus other reasons?
So unfortunately, the court data isn't super clear in how that's tracked, but if we were to assume, because most eviction filings are related to non-payment, we would assume most of these are due to non-payment.
That one's just super interesting to me. I think anytime somebody's kind of a frequent user of the same service over and over again, it seems like those 1,500 households need a different solution, other than rental assistance.
Well, so I think more wraparound services, right, which we've only kind of recently integrated more. So our process now is that when those folks are identified through the TRUA application process, we're adding a label to their application so our providers know, hey, these are a household and we should probably offer more wraparound supportive services to truly stabilize those folks
before
another eviction. Yeah.
It was interesting to me to see the statistics around what income level are seeking assistance, that 76% are under 30% area median income, but they're not all in subsidized housing. So where are they living?
That's a good question. Yeah. It's also, it could be, I mean, it's self-reported, right? So we're not income verifying through lots of documentation. So it could be also folks who are in this situation because they could afford and then they lost their job or reduced mm-hmm. hours. And so now their income is below 30%, which is why they're sending these services.
Okay.
So not that the, you know, where they're living is necessarily matching their income,
okay.
but that's why they're needing the services.
Do you have or are able to share the geographic distribution of where the evictions are happening?
I do have a map of that.
Yeah, if you could share that later.
Yeah, absolutely.
With
thanks.
All of us, yeah.
Yep.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
Councilmember Alvidres.
Thank you. I was looking at the data, and it looks like the waitlist has grown over 100%. Over the past year, there's 240-plus families with only 10 openings at a time. Is there any plan to reduce the wait list?
Which program? I'm sorry.
For the eviction defense.
Say that again.
For the whole program.
Where's the wait list, though?
The wait list? I thought I saw it on one of the slides.
I think it might be a different presentation.
Okay.
Sorry.
Maybe I was looking at the next presentation.
I think it might be, yeah.
Okay. Are all of these services available in multiple languages?
Yes.
Okay. And is there like a language access program that has a variety of languages?
Yeah, so we do both. I think most, if not all, have bilingual English Spanish staff. And then all of them are required to offer both translation interpretation services through other services if requested as needed.
Great. And then with this programming and preventing the eviction, is there also TRUA assistance by the same people, or how does that work?
Yeah, great question. So only one of the four eviction legal providers is also a TRUA provider. But what we do offer as part of the eviction clinic is, in addition to the eviction legal services, we've started to bring in our TRUA providers and other case managers. So both are on site, and whether it's them helping folks apply for TRUA, getting them information, other resources, or mediation, other wraparound services. And so a lot of time there is a lot of collaboration between the different organizations and sometimes referrals directly to TRUA from the eviction legal providers.
So in the office right across from me upstairs, I see they have the free eviction support. Is that the same program as this? Or is that through the courts?
That might be through the courts. Our eviction clinic is down on the first floor in room 163.
Okay.
Yeah.
So are we duplicating services then?
There are, not that I'm aware of, there are not other free eviction legal services.
Okay. So I think this might be volunteer by the Bar Association now that I think about this
thing. Okay.
But I'd be curious to learn more about that. And I know we're missing some of the data. Is there any goal or working towards getting those cases that we don't have the data on?
Always. Yeah, we're always trying to improve data collection. It is, you know, difficult. I think also, you know, being in the eviction process is traumatizing, and a lot of folks don't want to continue to engage or follow up. But we are working to administer surveys really across our portfolio of programs, and so hoping that helps us kind of glean and get more access to the data for how they're getting resolved.
Thank you. Thank you, Committee Chair.
Yeah, thank you. Councilmember Lewis.
Thank you. I might just have a quick question here, and this just may be a data point, but it kind of stuck out to me as I was looking at the slide on eight, or as I was looking at slide eight in the deck, and it shows the eviction legal assistance 2024 outcomes broken out by income levels, race, ethnicity, and then additional things. And the way that I read this is that, and I think we know this historically, is that Black folks, Indigenous folks, are often overrepresented when it comes to like homelessness, but even in this, and that's kind of what I'm seeing in the data here. And so I'm just curious if you all use this data point in any way to be able to address the overrepresentation of these communities or these demographics in how you might decide like what the value of a contract may be, or if you might need to apply additional dollars, or if you may need to think about additional or expanded programming for specific demographics to be able to address the disparities?
Yeah, that's a really good question. We do use the data, so we also have a tool, it's called the Equity Dashboard. So across all of our programs, we're looking at the households served and the demographics of those based on not just the overall city population, but those who would be eligible for each and every program. Uh-huh. And then discussing those with our providers at our quarterly site visits, annual monitorings. So unfortunately, because of the disparities that we're trying to address, we do tend to see the populations where there is, for example, a higher demographic for people experiencing homelessness compared to the citywide overall, we would want to see those folks accessing our services. Mm-hmm. So if we see any discrepancies in what we would want to see in that data, there is conversations about what better outreach can we do, what providers or community partners are we missing in this space. I will say for the most part, we continue to see it aligned with what we would want to see in terms of addressing equity, but it's always something we're monitoring.
That's insightful, because that makes it so then as I'm looking at this data point for where it says for Black and African American, it's 30%, and understanding that the population for Black and African American folks is like 8% on the high end in Denver, seeing it them overrepresented in this data, I don't want to say it's positive because that doesn't feel correct, but that's the intention, is to have that overrepresentation in order to be able to address the disparity.
We'd rather see it in our programs in the prevention and stability space than we would
on the other
people
side
experiencing homelessness. So if we saw the other, then we're clearly not reaching a demographic who is likely needing our services and should do a better job in that space.
That makes sense. Do you know what the percentages are for Black and Indigenous folks in terms of representation in homelessness?
I do not off the top of my head, but I bet my colleagues do have that somewhere.
I just wanted to know how it scales with seeing 30% here, and like, what does it look like on the other side of that?
Yeah.
And I was trying to see if there was any conclusion, I guess, or correlation, between you all catching it early versus, and if that is, if you're seeing positive impacts on the other side in terms of the data.
We're happy to follow up, because I know it's something we're tracking in that space too, because we do see the disparities showing up and have historically. So something for us all to be addressing through the full housing continuum.
Great. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thanks. Thank you. Councilmember Alvidres, go ahead.
I did have one more question. Of the households represented, do you have data on if they remain housed 6 or 12 months down the road?
We do not for this specific program, again, because it's difficult to get in touch with folks, but certainly something we've been discussing. With the TRUA program, it is something that we're following up with them on.
Great.
To find out where they are.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and I would just want to reiterate the same concern that Councilwoman Torres mentioned about people re-needing this assistance and how we can nip that in the bud. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner. Yeah.
Thank you. I just have a real quick question, and I think it aligns with some of my colleagues' questions around, we have the aggregated number of households served. I think some of that disaggregation for which agencies are maybe better connecting with specific communities would be helpful in thinking about what additional wraparound services. So I guess I'm kind of linking those together a little bit.
Sure.
I would be interested in seeing the map, and I think we've asked,
yep,
if everybody could see
Absolutely.
A map of where those households, where this is eviction is happening across the city. Do you have, how are these organizations standing independently? Are they embedded within other nonprofit organizations or in other places for those wraparound services?
They are independent organizations, but there's a lot of partnerships throughout. So for example, East Colfax Community Collective often works with our providers to do a Know Your Rights clinic, as well as a kind of tenant landlord counseling clinic. So information sharing there. There's also just various partnerships in the eviction clinic itself. So we'll bring in an eviction legal provider and a Truro provider to have those conversations. Same with Buku West on the west side is working closely with our nonprofits and Eviction Legal and Trua in terms of referrals and information, and we're meeting with those folks monthly. So lots of just, I guess, organic partnerships in the community.
Great. Yeah. Thank you. This is an action item. Do we have to...
So moved.
Okay. Okay. Sawyer. Sawyer, then Council President Sandoval. Okay, and everybody's in favor. Okay, got some. Everybody wanted to move that forward. Okay. So I think we're good. We don't have to have a vote on that. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And then we will take a moment to transition for our next presentation.
We're moving forward on the round table. I think it's going to
for host family services contracts.
No. Okay. I'll make sure that he reaches out to Jesse, right?
Yes. Okay. Thank you. Yeah. I can't wait.
It's fun. It's funny. I just asked Jesse about it.
I want to know. I'm looking at promoter underlying. I didn't sleep last night.
Okay, well, if you guys are ready, Jeff, go ahead and take it away with your team.
Great, thank you. Jeff Kosinski, Deputy Director for Shelter and Stability at Host.
And I'm Rosie McQuiggan, the Family Program Officer at Host.
Polly Kyle, Government Affairs Officer with Host.
Okay. We are here today to ask for you to review six contracts, five of which are ready for a vote. One will be presenting next week, the Tamarack Hotel. These are all related to family homelessness, and we'll talk a little bit about the current state of family homelessness in Denver. You just saw this with Melissa's presentation. The contracts that we are going to be talking about today both include non-congregate shelter as well as diversion and rapid resolution. I wanted to talk a little bit about the role of these programs in the homelessness response system. Shelters obviously are providing an important low barrier and life-saving program for people experiencing homelessness to get them out of cars, tents, and the streets and into shelter. The shelters all provide individual case management services such as rapid resolution, housing-focused case management, housing navigation, benefits navigation, et cetera. All of these services are provided by our nonprofit contractors. We do have, and you've seen this slide before, but accountability built into the system, including monthly, quarterly, and annual reviews of contracts. And a reminder, all contracts can be canceled with 30 days notice. And then we do have a regular RFP process that emphasizes past performance. Most of the contracts that we're looking at today are going to be multi-year contracts. Rosie, we'll get into that in a bit. We're also going to be talking about access to family shelter today through the Connection Center contract with Salvation Army. Access to family shelter is managed by Host and through the Connection Center, and priority access to shelter depends on each family's situations. And again, everything being run through Connection Center. I should also say that we do have a limited number of hotel vouchers that we can use on an emergency basis for families who are sleeping out of doors. Want to talk a little bit about the state of family homelessness in Denver. I know this issue has come up quite a bit, and there was some discussion about maybe having a hearing, but I think we'll provide some basic information, while unsheltered homelessness decreased by 83% in the 2025 PIC count, family homelessness overall increased about 150% from 2022 to 2025. And in the last 12 months, we've seen a nearly 100% increase in families, in households that are on the waiting list for non-congregate shelter. We believe this is due to a combination of factors, including rising eviction filings, a growing number of unhoused newcomers, and a deterioration of the social safety net, particularly in the area of childcare availability. Right now, based on the current inflow and outflow, we would expect to see 100 to 165 more families experiencing homelessness each year, as we're just not able to keep up with the inflow into the system. This is despite the fact that we've made consistent investments in the family shelter system since 2002, almost double the number of beds. We had 194 in 2022 and currently have 303 non-congregate shelter beds for families experiencing homelessness. And despite these efforts, we still see an increase in family homelessness, again, being driven largely by an increase in inflow into the system. In June of 2023, there were 89 families on the wait list, and today there's, it's I believe 230 today, actually, as of October 4th, it was 240. So it's gone down a bit. And again, another something I think we're proud about, but also concerned with at the same time, is that we're seeing we've seen an increase in the number of families that we're able to place into housing, 159 in 2022, 342 in 2024. But again, the problem still continues to grow despite nearly doubling our efforts. So that is kind of the current situation that we're in. Rosie will walk through the contracts. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And so, because this seems to be working a little better than going to the slides, this is a summary of the slides and the contracts. And we made some of the requests that we made last time we presented this. So hopefully this has all the data that was requested.
That's great. Thank you. So in the interest of time, I know you guys have a lot of questions about family homelessness and family shelter. So instead of going through all of the slides individually, I'll just go through the spreadsheet a little bit with you all. I think the most important pieces, if we look at the first side where it has the budget numbers, number of bed units, that's where I'll start. The biggest thing to note is that Tamarack will be switching over to Bayonne Works from Salvation Army starting on January 1st. We will not be losing any bed or units in that process, and we expect that all the services and resources will remain the same. It will just be a different provider. The budget for that will be slightly less. That has historically been an underspent contract, and so we're giving a little bit less money. They're also moving to a performance-based contract, which I know Jeff has walked through with you all pretty thoroughly, so I won't dig into that too much. The other things to note, most of these are only increasing slightly, mostly cost of living and some rapid resolution inclusion to try and help get some more positive exits out of the shelter system. But Theodora, their budget is increasing a bit, and that's because we're actually in that new building for the entire year as opposed to in that temporary East Colfax location, which is a little bit cheaper to run. And fewer families. I think they're increasing by about 20 units. In their new location, which is wonderful. So the total budget that we're looking at for next year is about $10.5 million for 303 family shelter units. Then we can flip over to the backside. And really what I just wanna highlight on this is the high rate of positive exits from our family shelter system. Folks do tend to stay there longer, but they're getting more resources, getting more services, and really making sustainable changes and exiting homelessness as opposed to cycling through the system. So we do have some higher lengths of stay, but that is because we've asked our shelters to really focus on finding that that solution and not just exiting folks back to street homelessness or another shelter. So I won't dig into all of these nitty gritty pieces. I know you guys can all take a look at this, and if you have questions, I know you will ask me of them.
I just add one thing is just to note is that the Tamarack is a 3-year contract and was just RFP'd out with the other non-congregate shelter hotels. All of these other contracts are going to be RFP'd in the spring of 2026, and then we will present 3-year contracts for those next year.
So then we will jump into family intake and access. So I know that this is another very important piece of the family shelter system, and that's the Connection Center, which I know that you guys are also all very familiar with. So that is the access point for all of the host funded family shelters in Denver. We are making some pretty significant changes to the program next year. This is something that we heard from you all, from the community, from families, from a whole lot of folks about what really needs to be changed. And so we're adding a significant amount of money to this contract for next year for additional staffing, as well as in-person vouchering at our cold weather sites. So, I don't think I need to run through all of the services that they provide at Connection Center. I think you all are pretty familiar, but we will be narrowing the scope a bit. It has historically acted as a bit of a call center where they field every call coming through if someone's looking for a food bank, substance use treatment, anything like that. And we realized that wasn't really the best use of money or their time and focus. They receive right now about 35 to 3,600 calls a month, which is just not sustainable as is. So we're really hoping to narrow the focus down to families experiencing literal homelessness or at risk of homelessness, so they can provide rapid resolution or access to family shelter or really focus on that cold weather. And so those are kind of all of the services that they provide. I won't walk you through the entire process. I think you're fairly familiar with that. And so I mentioned these are the changes that are coming. I think that the investment in rapid resolution will help us to divert some families from literal homelessness and from the family shelter waitlist. And so I know that there's gonna be questions about what we're doing to address the family shelter waitlist. And that is one way that we are working to address that is through providing those rapid resolution services up front to try and do as much diversion as possible, get folks into other more appropriate situations instead of having them enter the family shelter system. Or if they have entered the family shelter system, to quickly get them exited into permanent or stable housing. And then lastly, I think one of the most important changes is the cold weather access. And so last year we had incredibly high numbers of families. I think on the next slide, you can see how many households we actually served in cold weather. 506 unique families received cold weather vouchers last year, which is an incredibly high number, incredibly expensive. And so we are hoping that by doing in-person intake and screening for eligibility, we might be able to refer folks to more appropriate resources and to make sure that there are no folks accessing the system or these services who may not be appropriate for them, such as single adults. And those are really the greatest changes. And just to see the number, I think these are pretty vast numbers, just to see what they were serving out of the Connection Center. For a while, I believe it was only 8 staff people fielding all of these calls and doing all of this work. And so we are increasing that number up to 16 staff with the new funding that we are hoping to get approved for them. And that is all I have. Questions?
So many questions.
I know.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much for the presentation. We're going to go ahead and start with Councilmember Alvitres.
Thank you so much. This is really interesting information. Something that I just can't help but wonder, with the cost of the shelter system, how are we looking at, especially for families, vouchers versus cost of shelter and figuring out how we allocate those funds?
Are we talking hotel vouchers or housing vouchers?
That might be a Jeff question.
Sure. Well, housing vouchers come to us primarily from the state and federal government. And, you know, we've seen a significant rollback in availability of those vouchers. We do have rapid rehousing available for families. You know, again, this is a 1 year, in some cases up to 2 year rent subsidy that covers the cost of, you know, rent and services while families are getting stabilized. I'm doing a quick calculation for you. Yeah, so a shelter, we, you know, with the average length of stay of maybe, you know, 90 to 150 days, depending on the shelter and depending on the family, is going to cost about $12,000. $13,000 per family. Rapid rehousing is going to cost over twice that much. Of course, it hopefully puts families on a path to permanent exits, but I think it's a good question. I mean, we would like to see more rapid rehousing for families. We did get some added that's specifically focused for newcomers. It's just kind of rolling out this year. The cost on for shelter is lower, but shelter only solves sleep. Housing solves is what solves homelessness.
Yeah. And when you talk about the vouchers and the rapid rehousing and getting more funding for that, did that come from general fund or from Homelessness Resolution Fund, or where did that money come from?
Yes, general fund, Homelessness Resolution Fund, but a big chunk of it came from ARPA funding, which we no longer have access to.
That makes sense. Yeah. And then I know, for example, in my district, Warren Village had unit tied vouchers. Is that something we're still continuing to do?
Yes. I mean, there are still projects that are in development on the opportunity side of HOST that have tentative access or commitments, of vouchers. But just to be, you know, honest, like nobody really knows what's going to be happening at the federal level with the budget not being passed. And it's a little bit unclear and frankly concerning right now that we're not 100% sure which, you know, what's going to be available through the Denver Housing Authority.
Okay. So the ones for Warren Village, those were through DHA. I thought they were from.
I'm not sure. There are some local, there are some locally funded vouchers that exist, but there's not a lot. It's the city generally isn't providing, you know, as much funding around permanent long-term vouchers. Usually that's being funded by the state or through HUD, but there are some local vouchers available.
Okay, I can't help but compare to the previous slide that really hurt my heart as a single mom, that women head of households are a big part of this this population of unhoused families, but our families struggling with housing. In addition to that, I know that you talked about an inflow of families into the homeless system is a big cause of that, but I wonder if it is also the fact that a lot of our affordable housing is not built for families or not built multi-bedroom. And so I, you know, anecdotally would say that, but I would love to see some data around the affordable housing that we are providing and the number of bedrooms and how that could be affecting homelessness amongst families in the city of Denver.
Great. Yeah, we will get you the information on what's available and what's in the pipeline.
Great. Thank you. That's all for right now.
Okay. Thank you. Next up, I just want to clarify, Councilmember Lewis, were you in the queue?
Or? Yes.
Okay, great. You're next. And
I'm
then,
now?
Yes. Okay. I was trying to figure out if I had you in the right place.
You go.
I had you, and then I have Councilmember Sawyer.
Okay, there we go.
There you go.
So I had two questions on the slide, on slide 9. I have like 15 slides. I was totally unprepared to go next. Slide 9, it gave the numbers of, I think year over year, how many beds that, or how many units you all have been able to add. Does that number include what you would have to subtract year over year? And so I think about like the Radisson, the Comfort Inn, and losing those, is that the number
is the number that you have year over year inclusive of the number of units that you might be losing year over year as well?
Fortunately, on the family side, we're not losing any units. So, and the Radisson and Comfort Inn only serve single adults, so they're not included.
That's absolutely true. Okay. The second question I had for you is you mentioned that there are, that you all are seeing families sleeping on the streets, and I think this is the one of the things that we keep hearing from the administration, that there are no families sleeping on the streets. And so now I'm curious as to what is the number that exists in terms of the number of families that are on our streets?
Yeah, that's a good question, and it's a number that changes from, from night to night, so we don't really have a good, you know, in the point in time count, if memory serves, and I can get you this information, I think we identified, you know, less than 20, I think it was 8, if memory serves, individuals and families on the streets. But those were the number of people that our, you know, enumerators were able to find. So there are likely people that we're not, you know, we're not always going to find everybody, especially people sleeping in cars, especially people sleeping in cars who are parked on private property. Okay. So it's really difficult to know that exact number. When we do encounter families who are unsheltered and our outreach team gets a call, oftentimes we will work to place them in hotels, especially families who have a child under 2, a mom in the third trimester, or a family, anybody in the family who has a disability. They get oftentimes, but not always, placed into a hotel and then prioritized for shelter.
Okay, thank you. That's helpful. And then the last is just a comment. The Theodora is showing us it's in District 8, but it's in my kind friend's district. And so I'm happy to take your shelter. Okay. Thank you. That's it.
Thank you for that.
Great. Anything else? Okay, nope. Good. Okay. Yeah, great. We have Councilmember Sawyer and then Councilmember Torres.
Thanks. So I'm just curious about the call center. We're not calling it a call center anymore, the connection center. So the items that the connection center used to provide information about, right, food and security and things like that, what are, if they're not doing that anymore, where are we sending people who are asking for that kind of information now?
I think they'll be diverted to things like 211, and so they're setting up some phone tree systems, and so folks can say, it's like, press 1 for this service, press 2 for this service. So we'll get those routed to automated messages to let them know where they should be calling instead, more appropriate resources.
Okay. And then I have a lot more questions about that. but it, in terms of the connection center, is that going to be 24/7 now then? Or like, what are the hours? Because what we have always run into in our council office is that no one is calling for assistance at noon on Wednesday.
Right.
They are calling for assistance at 7 p.m. on Friday when there's a massive snowstorm that is supposed to hit in a half an hour, or those kinds of things. I see Councilman Torres nodding. I feel like this is something we all experience, right? So it's not helpful to us or anyone else if the connection center is open from 9 to 5 Monday through Friday.
Yeah.
Their current hours are 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. during the week. I believe the weekend hours are 7 to 12, but those may have been adjusted. During cold weather activation, however, families can access a voucher essentially 24/7, especially with the new on-site model that we have. Anyone can show up at that Zunai location that we're using for cold weather and access a voucher. We'll have Bayod staff there who will be able to provide the voucher to them.
Okay. I really appreciate that. I guess my concern is, and I'm just going to push back on that a little bit, and I know you guys are doing the absolute best you can, so do not take this in any way, shape, or form like I am criticizing you, but I don't want families sleeping on the streets ever in Denver, even if it's not below 30 degrees or 20 degrees or whatever we finally came down on as the decision on the degree amount that it was going to be for cold weather shelter, and even if it's not above 80 degrees at night, right? Like, children should not be sleeping on our streets. So I appreciate that there is that contact opportunity at the Zunai location during cold weather events or super hot weather events on the flip side. But it's not necessarily like a snowstorm rolling in. That was just an example of one thing that happened to me in my district a couple of years ago, right? Like, and that is an extreme example. We have families sleeping on our streets every night, no matter what the weather is. And if it's the weekend, if it's afternoon, and like, to me, it doesn't, that doesn't matter. So I'm just trying to figure out how we provide the services at the time people actually need them. Like, does 9 a.m. to noon or 7 a.m. to noon make sense on a Saturday and a Sunday morning? Like, it feels like maybe the right answer would be 4 p.m. to 9 p.m. when people figure out that they don't have a place to sleep that night.
Sure. That makes sense. Ideally, the Connection Center would be 24/7 in my world as well. And so I absolutely hear you on that. I think we could work with the Connection Center to talk about more appropriate hours if that's something that you guys would be interested in us exploring.
I feel like...
For the weekends, at least.
Yeah, I feel like it would be worth a conversation to consider. I don't know what other, like, things go into that decision-making process, right? So I feel like... That's a you question. If it were me, I would ask you to consider doing different times on the weekends in order to be more available for the times when the actual emergency is happening.
Yeah, I agree.
We have records of like when call, and you know, somebody calls and no one answers, like we know the call has come in, I assume, but we will double check that in setting the hours, Salvation Army and, you know, team are, you know, we're looking at that data to see when we're getting the most call volume.
Yeah.
We'll double check.
I appreciate that, because I will also say, like, when I had three children under eight in 18 months, it took me until like noon to get out of the house every day, right? Because everyone had to be now. Granted, we are talking about a population of people who are already sleeping on the street, so it might be a little bit different, and I don't have any experience with that I can speak from. But I feel like families in particular, takes them a little longer to get ready and get moving. And so if everything's closed at noon, that feels like just a missed opportunity.
That's a good point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we also need to tie it to like when evictions are happening, because that's oftentimes, you know, when the sheriff shows up, you know, when the family is going to need to make that phone call to find a place to be.
Yeah, because I don't know that they're showing up at 7 a.m. So, yeah, might be worth looking into. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Thank you. Councilmember Torres.
Thank you so much. The Connection Center, what percentage of the call volume will be the new call volume?
That is a great question, and I will have to get that data back to you. Yep.
Okay. I do think as long as 211 is still like as useful as it has been in the past, I think it's a really suitable place to divert folks. They're going to have more up-to-date information about food and utility assistance, things like that, that might be frequent questions. So just wanting to understand like what the load is that we're giving to this now, and like how we're setting up for success on that.
Sure. Yeah, okay. I can get that information.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. I do have a few questions as well. For the Connection Center, I know in the past they had there had been discussion about the actual infrastructure and their calls and their I want to say like their telephones, but I'm sure that it's a little bit more complex than that. Their system, is this going to help build that system, or is the Salvation Army working to upgrade their technology to be able to respond to calls?
I don't believe that they are going to upgrade their technology. I think they were able to find ways to build out a phone tree with the existing technology that they have. And so they have already started to make a lot of those changes in terms of diverting calls to the appropriate folks in different languages and things of that manner. And I think they will just continue building that piece out. In terms of the new technology, I don't think that is on the table as of right now. I think what they priced out was pretty expensive.
Yeah, but they did use some of their funds to upgrade the system to be able to add the the phone tree system in, again, just trying to reduce call volumes. All of us have heard concerns from families that it, you know, it takes a long time to get through, and hopefully this will direct, you know, it would be great if we had enough resources and we had 50 people there who could take all these calls and talk people through things about, you know, where they could get food or where they can get assistance with other services. But we really need the you know, the operators who are experts on helping people navigate, you know, towards shelter and out of homelessness to really just focus on that. So we had to, you know, we're trying to shrink the footprint a little bit through the use of technology.
Great. Thank you. When people call the Connection Center and, you know, we've been hearing a lot about, you know, names on a list and how long the list is at the Connection Center, people who are waiting for shelter, is that individuals, like, is it head of household or is it mom, I put my name on the list, or is it, and that's one, that counts as one, or is it me and two children and that counts as three? Like, how does that count? Is it
number,
per family,
like,
that are on the wait list?
Yeah. Yeah, it's families. Okay. So right now it's 230 families, and if memory serves, that's 893 individuals.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for the clarification. I wanted to ask a little bit more about the Tamarack Shelter. And I just want to thank you for the meetings that we've had and the planning and the connection and knowing that Bayard will be, you know, taking over and there is that transfer of knowledge and expertise right now. Are there any additional plans to do the capacity building for Bayard to serve families? I know this hasn't been there. It hasn't been something that they've done previously. Can you just talk a little bit about what that plan is?
Sure. My colleague Jesse Miller is sitting behind us, is meeting with Bayard and Salvation Army at least twice a week. I just attended one of those meetings today. So some of that knowledge transfer is happening that way. And then we are having an all-day training for our new providers on December 11th to help, you know, ensure that they know everything that they need to be able to make the transition happen smoothly. So far, I think we're very happy with the way Bayard has sort of stepped up to this and are confident that they're going to kind of bring things to the next level, you know, both for the guests who are staying at the Tamarack, but as well as the surrounding neighborhood. But we are spending a lot of time with them on the, you know, on the transition, and they will likely be hiring some of the Salvation Army staff who've been working with the families. So we're also navigating that. I believe tomorrow or the next night, they're having a meeting with all the Salvation Army staff in Bayard to sort of talk through, you know, what that's going to look like.
Terrific. I appreciate that. I know, and I appreciate the communication back with my office for a lot of that transition component. I think, you know, I'll hear from community, like, what's happening and what is this transition going to look like. So I think as much as we can be transparent and share what is going on, that's great. I also think in this, you know, in a time where so many of our systems are stressed, and the need is so incredibly high for food, for shelter, for housing, it helps to know what those needs are so that then we can communicate back out with community who want to step up and give and contribute to that success. So if you can just continue to share, that would be incredibly helpful. I'm going to go to Council President Sandoval and then to Council Member Torres.
Get back in.
So and then I'll be dressed.
In the presentation, I'm trying to find it. So you use this broad term households, and households doesn't always, I mean, it can relate to people, but how many people?
In the, on the waiting list, 893.
Okay. So that's a, thank you for saying that. It's the first time I've heard that number. And then for the Connection Center, is it working for the households that you're seeing, like the makeup for the kids and how, so when you're, oftentimes, let me say this a different way.
My dog had a severe incident the other day, and I got a follow-up survey saying, hey, what services did you need? What could we have done different? Do we do any of that type of surveying with people at the Connection Center? To Councilman Sawyer's point, that would be a good time to figure out what they're hearing, if that's the good time, if the timing is working. So because Councilman Torres also mentioned, you know, there's repeat people in within all of our systems. And so have we ever taken the time to create a survey to figure out, are we actually providing your needs? And then what are those survey results from the users, the end users? Does that make sense?
Yep. So I think my first meeting ever with Councilwoman Lewis was about this very topic, and getting feedback from the people who are receiving services. And although we were hoping to have this rolled out in July, we will be rolling this out next month across all of our programs, in which we will be receiving surveys in the shelters. There'll be physical kiosks for programs like Connection Center. There'll be a survey that people can complete. And then we will have quarterly reports back that will help us understand what's going on. And I'm also really excited the company we're working with has an AI product that will read all of the comments and be able to give us trends about what's happening. And they also work, they do this nationally in shelter systems and in other types of programs. We'll be able to see how we're doing compared to other communities in terms of customer satisfaction. So probably we'll have data for you, but just being conservative, like first quarter of next year.
And okay, great, that's awesome. Who helped you frame those questions? What's this company's name?
Pulse for Good.
I'm sorry, say it one more time.
Pulse for Good.
Okay.
So
are they a national leader in this field, or how did we find?
Yeah, them? Well, they responded to an RFP, but they are a leader in the field and do the survey development. But we also worked with our providers and other stakeholders on designing the questions, and we can of course change them as we need to. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we selected them in part due to their expertise in working in data collection for the population that we're serving.
Okay. And for last night, we had, I'm sure you all know, we had a long public hearing, and there were several people who gave public testimony, been here for a long time, and I've never heard public testimony like that at a budget hearing of single moms. And what process do we have? Like, yes, they're in our shelters longer. If we had a magic Harry Potter wand and we lived in a different reality where we weren't getting federal funding cutting and we weren't getting vouchers taken away, how much more of a system would we need to create to be able to meet the need so that we can make sure that families aren't not sheltered in Denver? That's our biggest issue.
That families aren't?
That unsheltered.
Unsheltered, yeah.
There's 800 plus on the current waiting list. That's families, individuals, and then some that equates to what, 300 something? Families or something,
230.
Yeah.
Yep.
So what do we need to do different?
Thank you for that question. It's something we think about a lot. One thing I will say, there's no like one thing.
Yeah.
Like let's just open a 900 bed shelter. It's a complicated problem. I should start out by saying that many of the families on the waiting list the vast majority are not sleeping outside. They're doubled up. They're going from motel to motel. And by outside, that includes like cars, tents, whatever. So there certainly are families who are staying in cars. There are occasionally families sleeping outside. It's, it's a percentage of that 230 households. But if we wanted to have a system, and it's also, we do have, and it shouldn't matter what zip code somebody came from, but we do have a lot of people coming from other counties seeking shelter in Denver. But I would say the first thing that I would do is to open up an emergency congregate shelter for families so that in an emergency situation, like nobody has to sleep outside. And it may not be ideal, but once we can get them inside into a congregant setting, we can then get them into the non-congregant. I'd rather them be waiting in a congregate setting rather than, you know, sleeping out of doors in an emergency situation. It's not sustainable for us to be able to place everybody into hotels. It's just too expensive, and it also, you know, again, not, we don't screen for where somebody came from, so we're just getting overwhelmed with requests for hotel vouchers. But I think if we can have a front door to the system, and many other communities have this. I know it would be new for Denver, San Diego, San Francisco, LA. I used to work in family homelessness. That's prior to going to work for the city of San Francisco. I ran the biggest homeless service provider in San Francisco, and we ran multiple congregate sites. It's not ideal, but it did help us achieve the goal, which unfortunately kind of slipped backwards with the current economic situation. But there was a good period of time in San Francisco where there were no families needing to sleep outside. There was, and we measured that by, is there space in the shelter system?
So if I hear you just summing it up, saying it a different way, there's models out there when it comes to unsheltered families that show that if we have a congregate emergency shelter system, it helps on the other end. Because that's what I'm hearing you say, because I've heard this issue of unsheltered families for a long time. I mean, like a long time. Like I knew friends who had it, right? I knew friends who grew up in subsidized housing. But we've done such a good job in these other spaces that in the five-year plan that HOST has to create, I feel like we're always adding another layer to what we're creating, right? And I think right now what we're seeing throughout the nation is these unsheltered, a lot more higher rate of unsheltered families in certain parts that are really tackling, doing their best to tackle something that's been around for as long as, you know, Jesus, we've had people experiencing homelessness. And so we need to get, and it's that whole wraparound service. But thank you for saying that, because I think all of us at this table want to participate in helping bring resources. And it's really, as a mom, to have someone in another language tell you in Spanish, the language my father learned, that they don't have anywhere to go, is something I've never, like at a public hearing, at a budget hearing, I've never experienced. And at one point we had one of the biggest camps was in Council District 1 at the Zunai Hotel, from people from Venezuela. I lived that for like 7 months of my life and my community. And so to see what's reverberated after with Trump, I can't even say president, he's just Trump to me right now. He's lucky I even say that. And the damage and like the SNAP benefits and all of these things that are coming to a head, we all just have to really start thinking creative and look at other models and invest in those. So thank you, Madam Chair.
If I could also just add, I mean, I think that's just a component we don't have in Denver. Yeah. I'm not saying
it's
that that's
a puzzle piece. It's not the silver bullet.
Yeah.
There's no silver bullet.
But I think, you know, investments, prevention is obviously really important. You know, because it's you know, it's like a bathtub that's always filling up. If we don't slow down the water, we're never going to be able to, you know, the bathtub's just going to keep overflowing. And we also need more housing exits. Like we could invest in more non-congregate shelter. And, you know, but I think there's parts of the system that prevention, housing, and maybe some type of emergency response that would help at least mitigate the some of the harm that's being done. And I feel like I agree that, and I think we all agree, there should not be children sleeping outside ever. And if that's the problem we're trying to solve, having some kind of emergency response in place, like we see during the winter, is, you know, I think maybe a good direction.
Thank you. I'm going to pause just for a minute, and for time's sake,
We have one more briefing, and it's my, I'm sorry. I looked down. This is an action item.
This one?
This is an action
item.
So
moved.
So, okay, Sawyer first. Do we have a second?
Second.
Do we need a vote? And I know that there are some other people in the queue. Can we just submit those questions to them so that they can be answered? If we don't do this briefing in the next 15 minutes, and I apologize, it's about host central command, we won't get back on the calendar until February. So I apologize that I did not monitor it, but I think this was such an important conversation and very timely with what we heard and have been hearing at public comment and, you know, in our council inboxes. So I just wanted to give space for that conversation. So thank you very much.
You.
Again, it's a very tight timeline, and my apologies, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. So whenever you guys are, whenever you're ready.
Hello, folks. My name is Evangeline Benja. I am the Assistant Director of Homelessness Resolution for HOST.
Dory Higa, she, her pronouns. I'm the Director of Homelessness Resolution Programs at HOST.
You guys are lucky. I'm from New Zealand, so I have a propensity for speaking really quickly. So we'll get through this quick. So today we are talking about Housing Central Command that really lives in the rehousing space. So we're working predominantly with rapid rehousing and then stabilization case management as well. The action requested today is a review of the following contracts for services related to our Housing Central Command. The first one is the community firm who does business as the Community Economic Defence Project, or CEDP, and they're doing navigation for us for 2026. It'll be $1,243,974. The Colorado Coalition for the Homeless will be supporting our stabilization efforts for 2026. The cost of that will be $2,083,248. And for Housing Connector, who will be running our rent payer and unit acquisition for 2026, it'll be $2,638,400. So Housing Central Command is a crisis response model. We use emergency management staffing to maximize the resources that we have available to us. So the goal is really to quickly connect folks to the housing resources, quickly get them into housing, and then support their ongoing stabilization. Everyone enters through our coordinated entry system, so we're trying to really ensure that that equity piece is met. We're not cherry-picking folks that are ready for housing. All of our folks have completed a community coordinated entry assessment, which is self-determined, and then they're connected through a referral to our housing navigation team. At the same time as that's happening, we have our unit acquisition team finding us a unit inventory appropriate for all of our folks. And then once folks are leased up, navigation is then doing a warm handoff over to our stabilization teams, who are taking over for up to 12 months of critical time intervention focused case management. The biggest piece there is that folks are planning for their exits from the very beginning, from the minute they're connected to housing, so that they're not blindsided when the subsidy ends. So the phases of our programs are navigation. This is going to be run by CDP. The big thing that they're working on is getting our clients completely ready for that lease up. So document acquisition, uploading things to the relevant places, completing unit applications, making sure they're going through what folks' preferences are, helping folks pack, prepare for that move-in, and then going through to lease up, handing off to the stabilizers. Our unit search team are working with landlords and property partners to create an inventory that operates at 125% of our need. And they are also helping manage some of those other pieces for us, reducing barriers. If we know we have someone who doesn't have a photo ID, for example, they're able to help us negotiate with landlords to get them in without that, knowing that in good faith it'll be coming because this person's going to have ongoing case management supports. And then this team also is responsible for a portion of our rent payment. Housing stabilization, that's really move-in and beyond support. So they're supporting with basic needs, referrals to other community programs, really focusing and a big emphasis on building community connections for our clients, focusing on other things like increasing income so that folks can maintain their housing after the 12 months of support has ended. It's mobile, they're meeting folks at their houses, and they're usually working at a 1 to 20 client to staff ratio, or staff to client ratio. So our impacts in 2025, we've housed 351 folks out of a goal of 399, so we're at 88% of our goal. This graph just shows you how many folks we've housed each month of this year. We currently have 67 folks engaged in housing search, so we're on track to meet our goal, and we're averaging around 39 days from referral to referral received to housed outcome. We've seen 144 exits to permanent and stable housing. We have set up regular case conferencing for those stabilization case managers to make sure they're getting the technical support they need, and we're also aware of what's going on with all of our clients. And we have had 182 households return to shelter after program completion to continue working on their housing. Some successes that we noted throughout the RFP process for this. So the community firm, or CEDP, has operated a tenancy support services program that were attached to some state housing vouchers we received. They really showed us their commitment to quickly connecting folks to housing, an average 52 days to housing for participants. That's without having a unit inventory as fancy as what we have. So we're excited for them to work with us on navigation. They also keep really clear records in their HMAS, so their data quality is really good. CCH, Colorado Coalition for the Homeless, has been with us since the beginning of our HCC efforts. They've really played a strong hand in how we support folks through stabilization and are really committed to our critical time intervention model. So we're excited to continue that and grow that partnership with them. And then Housing Connector has, by the end of quarter two, had already reached 124% of the goal that they had committed to serving for us. They're really on time with their rent payments, and they're really communicative with us. We've had a weekly meeting with them going since this time last year. So they're really connected and involved in the HCC processes. For 2026, some shifts that we're making is moving to centralized navigation. So we've been working with three specific programs. We're now going to work with up to 10, and the goal for next year is to hit 400 households through all of our different rapid rehousing programs that are funded by HOST. I think all of the presentations mentioned this, but we're really working to create consistency across our programs, wanting to create and maintain best practices and make sure that all of our clients know what they're getting into when they're signing up for our housing programs, and regardless of who their provider is, getting the same level of great support. And then we're increasing data quality across all of our programs, so we're really working with our folks and having continuous and consistent connection with them to make sure that they are recording data in a good, accurate way.
Okay. I'm going to just pause a minute. We have about 5 minutes left. The producer said that they could stay if we'd like to stay overtime. Would that work for committee? Okay. So we'll have just a few more minutes, and we can sprint and make this work. Great. Thank you.
Right. I'll sprint through this. So the dedicated HCC staffing is the thing I really want to talk about on this slide. Where we've had reassigned staff from shelter contracts in 2025, we're moving towards having a specific stabilization team, specific navigation team, and having a single rent payer as well. So again, these are our contracts we're going through. Community Firm is providing the navigation. It's going to be a three-year contract. We're still in contract negotiations, so I don't have those 27, 28 final numbers for you, but we will get those to you. The Colorado Coalition for the Homeless also will be a three-year contract. Same deal in contract negotiation. And same goes for the Housing Connector contract. We are figuring out the 27, 28. And then there is a Salvation Army contract for $410,000. It's just a six-month contract just to round out their final folks receiving rental assistance in their program. That one won't come to council, but just for you to be aware of. So
I think you just let this part go.
Okay, right. I'll talk through the changes. So we're moving from having 10 navigators from multiple providers to four dedicated navigators from a single provider, and really focusing on expanding the number of housing programs we're working with through navigation. The stabilization is moving from six stabilization case managers to 16 to continue to support folks that have been housed in 2025 and the 140 additional folks we will house through this specific program in 2026.
And just to clarify, CCH had six housing stabilization case managers and is moving to 16, but we've had about 20 this year.
And then Housing Connector are going to be increasing their unit inventory from this year. So we asked them to go at 125% of our need. We know we need around 400 units. They're committed to providing us 500 units on the community hub Airtable platform that they provide to us. I think that I'll call it there because I'm sure you have questions.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. And again, we do have some folks in the queue. We'll start with Council Member Lewis.
Dang, okay, again. just one quick question. So I was thinking about the cuts that you all have taken over with the $33.5 million. And then I see additions here. And so I guess I'm trying to square those. Like, what have you all had to move around or maybe cut in order to be able to scale some of these things that you've shown us here?
Yeah, when we proposed our budget for Housing Central Command for this year, we were looking at closer to like $15 million, and that's not what we're awarding at all. So it's much less than half of what we were hoping to have and be able to do for this year. So some of the expansions maybe look like expansion. So for example, we're doing more navigation. The idea isn't that we have 400 specific slots for folks to go into, but that the team would have capacity. Because the idea is that each navigator would support about 10 households a month. And we talk about 10 months in the year because, you know, the winter months are tough for anybody. Also, it's hard to release folks up in December, January.
Okay.
So we're saying four navigators would support about 40 people a month times 10 months would be 400 people. And that's not just navigation through the resources that we have identified at host, but we're hoping to use those navigators for any other type of one home referral that exists, other types of supportive housing programs. If there's a lull in the housing resource availability, they would be supporting folks in shelters to be ready to lease up, doing more sort of workshops with folks about tenant responsibilities, what to expect when they move into somewhere else, providing some other types of trainings across the community. So we intend to fully utilize the team even if we don't have 400 housing spots next year.
Yeah. You said it's about half, like what you all are proposing is about half?
Oh, the numbers of what we are proposing?
Uh-huh.
No, I did not say that. Sorry.
I misunderstood.
Yeah, it's okay. I think that we're still putting all those pieces together as we're working through some of our final awards for both the supportive housing contracts as well. So we won't have that number to you in the very near future. I would say that more in December, we would have a clear idea of what those goals would look like and what's possible with our resources.
Understood. Do you anticipate that you'll be in a space to have to serve less people because you've had to put together the budget that you all have versus the budget that you would have done if you were able to scale it to the degree that you could have if $33.5 million wasn't
from you? Yes, I'm just going to say yes.
I'll take the yes.
That's okay.
Okay. That's good. That's it.
Yeah.
Great. Councilmember Torres and, oh, sorry. And are you also?
No.
Okay. Councilmember Torres, thank you.
Everyone's running from the questions. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you both. Yeah. Trying to understand, just because we're in the midst of budget, and you've got a 3-year contract for these. I'm assuming what gets reflected in the budget book is just the 2026 allocation. Do you know which activity area that comes out of?
I don't like the budget book. It doesn't look like how my brain works. I don't so I can't tell you what activity, but I will tell you, like, all of these things are part of our homelessness resolution pillar, right, under Jeff. And so I don't know if that equates. Do you guys know? We can get back to you.
Okay.
Yeah.
If it's clearly in there, that would be great to know. Just where you're at.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. So if I have this correctly, I just remember we went on a site visit and they had, and you showed us a big table, like, and all the providers sit around the table. This is kind of the consolidation of all of those providers coming together and strategizing about what was the best kind of next step.
Yeah.
Two.
So Housing Central Command has greatly evolved in the last year plus in has many different iterations and will continue to, right, as we refine and know what resources that we have available. So we're really working for more of a virtual model with the intention to make sure our support team, whether that's navigators or stabilizers, are meeting the community where they're at. And this last year, most of our efforts had been placed within All in Mile High sites, and some of our concentration will be there in the coming year. But we also want to expand those efforts to other shelter sites, including families and supporting navigation for families as well. So it means that they need to be highly mobile, and locking folks down in a place isn't necessarily helpful for that. Like, if you need to have your stand-up meeting in the morning from your coffee table, like, have your meeting there because it's easier for you to get to where you need to be rather than traversing all over town. Yeah. So the goal is to be as highly mobile as we can.
I appreciate that. And I just think it seems as though it's gone from, it's just evolved pretty significantly. Yeah. So I appreciate that. Thank you. Do we have any other council members that have questions? No, thank you so much. I appreciate it. This is a briefing, not an action item, so we don't need a vote. For a minute there, I thought so too.
Because there were contracts.
But we don't have anything on consent. And if there's nothing else, this meeting is now adjourned. Thank you very much.